Cha-cha-ching. Hello, gang. Hello, this is King Kong here. And we're ready to do all those things, you know, in that incredibly important way we have of doing things. Come on, get a good running start there and get that kite up in the air. Get that kite up in the air. Pick up them feet. Pick up them knees. Come on, let's go. Get that kite flying, please. About every year or two, I do a show about Archie, of Archie and Mehitable fame. And for those of you who have never actually heard the works of Archie, the verse libre poet, you've come to the right spot, as Archie would say. And Archie was the creation of a late writer for New York newspapers by name Don Marquis, occasionally called Don Marquis by the more erudite Franco Fields among us. But nevertheless, he wrote for the New York papers. And I don't really know what papers he wrote for. Because it was certainly, according to the book I have here, by the New York Sun paper he wrote. And the story of Archie was the story of a cockroach, actually. Archie the Cockroach was a free verse poet in life. So Archie, who was created by Don Marquis, was a poet who had passed into the great beyond, a verse libre, or a free verse poet. And he returned, due to the fact that he was such a terrible poet, he returned to what he really deserved in his second life, which is a cockroach. But he could not help himself. He continued to be a poet. And he lived in this newspaper office, as we did. And every night, Don Marquis would leave his typewriter. You know, he's finished writing his column. He's a columnist, you see. He'd leave his typewriter there. And poor little Archie the Cockroach would come in and beat out this poetry, which he would leave for his boss, Don Marquis. He just called him boss, actually. He didn't really work for him. He used him. He oppressed him. He didn't actually use them. So he would come in, and since he was a very small cockroach, as cockroaches tend to be, he couldn't operate the keyboard correctly. He could not, among other things, he couldn't operate the capital bar. He couldn't raise the platen there, whatever they call it. And so he would run back and forth on the keys, and he would knock out his poetry by hitting his head on the keys. And it was all in small type. And Mr. Marquis would find these poems in his typewriter the next day. And he would put them in his column, you know, let you hear what Archie is saying. So he had a whole bunch of friends, being a cockroach. Among the friends he had was Mehitable the cat, who was his rotten alley cat, hung around in the back of the place there. You know, a lot of people know the more obvious stuff, but boy, some of this stuff is really great. Now, let's see, Archie is shocked. Archie interviews a spider and a fly, the merry flea. Would you like to hear the story of the merry flea, his little friend? Number 34. All right, I'll give you that one. So hold on there. Number 34. All right. No, I don't know. That's kind of long. Here's one. Listen to this one. This is called A Spider and a Fly. It's kind of a good one. So if you'll set that up in there, just a little more of that in there. Just keep using that stuff. That's good stuff for Archie and Mehitable. Yes, sir. All set? Any one of the cuts. It really doesn't matter. They're all the same. All right. A spider and a fly. And remember, this is a cockroach writing a letter to his boss. I heard a spider and a fly arguing. Wait, said the fly. Do not eat me. I serve a great purpose in the world. You'll have to show me, said the spider. Well, I scurry around gutters and sewers and garbage cans, said the fly, and gather up the germs of typhoid influenza and pneumonia on my feet and wings. Then I carry these germs into the households of men and give them diseases. All the people who have lived have the right to have the sword of life recover from the diseases, and the old soaks who have weakened their systems with liquor and iniquity succumb. It is my mission to help rid the world of these wicked persons. I, the fly, am a vessel of righteousness, scattering seeds of justice and serving the noblest uses. Oh, well, it is true, said the spider, that you are more useful in a plotting, material sort of way than I am, but I do not serve the utilitarian deities. I serve the gods of beauty. Look at those gossamer webs I weave. Look at those. They float in the sun like filaments of song, if you get what I mean. I do not work at anything. I play all the time. I am busy with the stuff of enchantment and the materials of fairyland. My works transcend utility. I am the artist, a creator, and a demigod. It is ridiculous to suppose that I should be denied the food I need in order to continue to create beauty. I tell you plainly, Mr. Fly, it is all damned nonsense for that food to rear up on its hind legs and say it should not be eaten. You've convinced me, said the fly. Say no more. And shutting all his eyes, he prepared himself for dinner. And yet, he said, I could have made out a case for myself, too, if I had a better line of talk. Of course you could have, said the spider, clutching a sirloin from him. But the end would have been just the same if neither of us had spoken at all. Boss, I'm afraid that what the spider said is true. And it gives me to think furiously upon the futility of literature. Did you really listen to that poem? How's that for a nice piece of work? Oh, but that's just the beginning, friends. Just the beginning. I went into a speakeasy the other night, boss, with some of the boys, and we were all sitting around under one of the tables and making merry with crumbs and cheese and whatnot. But after a while, a strange melancholy sort of descended upon the jolly crew. And one old brown veteran cockroach said with a sigh, well, boys, eat, drink, and be maudlin, for tomorrow we are dry. The shadow of the padlock rushes towards us like a Sahara sandstorm flinging itself at an oasis. For years, myself and my ancestors before me have inhabited yonder icebox. But the day approaches when our old homestead will be taken away from here and scalded out. Yes, says I, soon there will be nothing but just soda pop to drink. And so I put it down the way it is. Boss, there's nothing like a good drink of bourbon to keep a man's spirits up, not to mention a cockroach. That's a song on the closing of a tavern. Oh, hold it a minute, Art. I'm going to find one of my absolute favorites here. This, you know, like in any, you know, it's hard to believe that this stuff, according to the copyrights on this stuff was written about the time and just after World War I. And it has a curious contemporary sound to it. Now, here's another one. And his sense of humor and such great irony that runs through his stuff. And I picked this book up. Now, if anybody's interested, I'm a great, at least I used to be for a while there. I used to hang around these used bookshops down on 4th Street. You've been down a lot of those over on the east side over there. And 4th Avenue, rather. And there's some places down there where you can buy books. They have them in catalogs, categories, really. And so I picked this up some time ago. And when I was a kid, I never was much of a poetry fan, one way or the other. Maybe because I had to learn poetry by heart. It says, oh, boy, I have more torture learning stuff like, I tear her tattered ensign down, long may it wave on high. Shoo! I mean, it made me, I used to get feel sick inside. One thing that shows that insects are superior to men, boss, is the fact that insects run their affairs without political campaigns, elections, and so forth. A man thinks he amounts to a lot, but to a mosquito, boss, a man is merely something to eat. I've noticed that when chickens quit quarreling over their food, they often find that there's enough for all of them. I wonder if it might not be the same way with a human race. Germs are very objectionable to men. But a germ thinks of a man as only the swamp in which he has to live. A louse I know, boss. He once told me right out plain, that millionaires and bums tasted about alike to him. Just like that, you know? The trouble with most people is that they lose their sense of proportion. Of what use is it for a queen bee to fall in love with a bull? What is all this mystery about the Sphinx that has troubled so many illustrious men? No doubt the very same thoughts she thinks are thought every day by some obscure hen. Archie. Thank you. Thank you. Now, you know... Thank you. Thank you. Now, I'm not... Thank you. Thank you. It's real good. I'm not... you know, I'm... the reason I'm reading this tonight, it's a very funny little thing happened. And I'm not going to give any names or anything like that, but I got a letter from somebody, a teacher, in fact, who teaches here in New York. And she said that she had a kid in her class who she was a little worried about, you know. He was quiet and very introspective and never really made contact with the class or anything like that. And she said a very wild thing happened to this kid, that one day, suddenly, without any warning, he heard me doing on the air, he happened to run across my show, Don Marquis, Cockroaches. And the kid went out of his bird. And she said, practically overnight, it completely changed this whole kid's attitude. He walks around with volumes of Don Marquis now, and she says he writes poetry a la Archie. She says the kid has changed completely. Well, now that's... Don Marquis would love that. He really would. You know, any writer who no matter what he writes and where he writes it, would, you know, just flip if he knows that he has really changed somebody. Somebody really was turned... I hate to use the word turned on, but somebody was really transformed because of what this guy wrote. Now, listen to this one. Here's a story of... This is a fascinating little poem here. It's called Archie and the Old One. Just give me a little sound there, if you will, Arthur. And this is Archie talking about an old one. He said, one of the saddest creatures, boss, I ever saw was a turtle. He said he was 1,000 years old. Now, boss, no turtle looks very joyous. The style of architecture peculiar to the faces and necks of turtles is such that even if they were to feel gay internally, they would find difficulty in expressing their joy. A kind of melancholy dwells in the wrinkles of a turtle's neck. Actually, boss, the only thing that looks sadder than a turtle is a little dead fish that is served in an Italian table d'hôte restaurant. Well, boss, this turtle I'm telling you about was so old that he used to be a pet of Charlemagne. And he finally committed suicide. He stood on his hind legs and jumped up and bit himself on the forehead and held down until he died. I wrote a poem about this turtle after his death, which goes as follows. Why did he die? Perhaps he knew too much about the ways of men and turtles. He had seen too much, no doubt. Optimist in youth, of course. No doubt he was. Youth never quails. He preached to all his brother turtles. Moral, turtles turn to whales. But the weary age is past, and he perceived turtles still continued to be turtles. Then he doubted, disbelieved, brooding for 200 years in discontent. He became a snapping turtle, savage cynic in his bent. Timon of the turtle tribe, so he withdrew from the world, remarking often, piffle, there is nothing true, nothing changes. All the salt that used to be scattered widely through the ocean still gives flavor to the sea. Nothing changes. All the bunk of long ago is still swallowed by the nations. Progress always stubs its toe. The moral? Well, the moral's quite an easy one, boys. Do not live to be 1,000. You'll be sorry ere you're done. The only way, boss, to keep hope in the world is to keep changing its population frequently. I am sorry to be so pessimistic today, but I see I need a change very badly. Boss, when do we start for Hollywood? I am eager to be gone. I wish to cheer myself up in some fashion. Your faithful little cockroach, Archibald. You want to hear one? A series called Archigrams? Archigrams. The woodlouse sits on a splinter and sings to the rising sap. Ain't it awful how winter lingers in springtime's lap? It's an Archigram. It is a good thing not to be too aristocratic. The oldest and most pedigreed families in this country are the occupants of various sarcophagi in the museums. But it is dull associating with mummies, no matter how royal their blood used to be when they had blood. It is a little like living in Philadelphia. It's an Archigram. Honesty is a good thing, boss, but it is not profitable to its possessor unless it is kept under control. If you are not honest at all, everybody hates you. But if you are absolutely honest, you get martyred. Think about that one for a minute. Moss, as I was crawling through the holes in a Swiss cheese the other day, it occurred to me to wonder what a Swiss cheese would think if a Swiss cheese could think. And after cogitating for some time, I said to myself, if a Swiss cheese could think, it would think that a Swiss cheese was the most important thing in the whole world. Just as everything that can think at all does think about itself. Okay. Are you a working anarchist? You want to hear what Archie said about anarchy? These anarchists that are going to destroy organized society and civilization and everything remind me of an ant I knew one time. He was a big red ant, a regular bull of an ant, and he came bulging down a garden path and ran into a stone gatepost. Curses on you, said the ant to the stone gatepost. Get out of my way. But the stone never budged. I will kick you over, said the ant. And he kicked, but it only hurt his hind legs. Well then, said the ant, I will eat you down. And he began taking little bites in a great rage. Maybe I said, you will do it in time, ant, but it will spoil your digestion first. Do you think you're going to change the world? A good many failures are happy because they don't realize it. Many a cockroach believes himself as beautiful as a butterfly. Have a heart. Oh, have a heart. And let them dream on. There's a goodie. Boss, I believe that the millennium will get here someday, but I could compile quite a list of persons who will have to go first. There's a goodie for you. 'Tis very seldom I have felt drawn to a scallop or a smelt. And still more rarely do I feel love for the sleek electric eel. That's an Archigram. Here's a quick Archigram. The oyster is useful in his fashion, but he has little pride or passion. Oh, yeah. You know, did you ever notice that when a politician does get an idea, he usually gets it all wrong? That's an Archigram. One queer thing about spring gardens is that so many people use them to raise spinach in instead of food. Everybody has two kinds of friends. One kind tries to run his affairs for him, and the other kind... Well, I'll be darned if I can remember the other kind. Now and then there is a person born who is so unlucky that he runs into accidents, which started out to happen to somebody else. Thank you. All right, thank you, Arthur. You know, I'll tell you, I don't mean to trouble you with this, but one of the most embarrassing things that I've had happen to me recently, talking about Archie and Mehitable, it was about 2 years ago, something like that, and I go back home. You know, I go out to see, you know how you do. You have to occasionally go out and see your mother and all that stuff and the people who you left behind in the rubble of your past. So I'm out there visiting my mother, see. It's one of those things over a holiday, and And finally, she says, listen, she said, there's a lot of your junk down in the basement. She said, what am I going to do about it? She said, do you want me to throw it out or what? I said, what junk? She said, well, you got a lot of your stuff, you know. You got a lot of junk down in the basement. It's under the stairs. Down where I put all the canned goods and junk. I said, got stuff I've got? She said, yeah, it's down there. Well, I went down in the basement to see, you know, what the stuff was. And it was a big cardboard box. And I dragged it out from under the stairs. And the first thing that I found was a tennis racket, which, when I first looked at it, I didn't remember owning. I looked at it, and vaguely from out of my past, there it was. It was my old tennis racket that I had when I was like 12, you know? And it was a lot of other junk. I mean, total trivia stuff that, you know, didn't matter one way or the other. But amid all this crud, I don't know what to do with it. I think I've been debating ever since. I have it here. I have it here in New York now. It's hidden in a drawer in my desk, and I'm not about to do anything rash with it. It was a gray notebook. You know the kind of gray notebooks? It's kind of a mottled black and gray cover. It looks like a ledger or something like that, one of those ring notebooks with hard cardboard covers. And I remember buying that notebook. I was about 14 or 15, roughly. I bought this notebook at the bookstore in high school. And I brought it back, took it home. And the first two or three pages I used in a class that I was taking at that time, and the notes are still in there, in a physics class. I was taking physics, and I had pictures of fulcrums. I mean, everybody's drawn a fulcrum in his time, and I was real good drawing fulcrums. And I had things like a pulleys drawn, you know, with arrows going up and down, one arrow pointing up and the other arrow pointing down, and it had weights on the bottom and stuff like that. That's the moments of inertia. I've had a lot of moments of inertia, boy, I'll tell you. And so the first three pages were about physics. And I was leafing through the notebook. I knew there was something funny about that notebook from the minute I found it in that box. And I leafed through it. And I went through a brief period, which came back to me and went, ooh. It made me, you know, it made me feel kind of queasy. I went through a period when I was 14 or 15 of writing poetry. Did you ever go through that at all, Art? Did you ever go through a period where you wrote poetry? Would you like to see some of your poetry now? Well, I think everybody goes through this thing. I'm not going to be so egotistical as to say that showed that I was a sensitive child. Not at all. If you read my poetry, it was the poetry of a total clod. But you know, the usual mooning over the moon and usual drippy stuff about love and about the, it's unbelievable. So I took this thing out, see, and I'm starting to look at it. I'm sitting down in the basement, and I read these poems, and I had them with terrible names, names like The Unturned Stone, that kind of stuff, or The Dying Moon, great names. One of the names had to do with an arrow. It said, upon shooting an arrow. You know, kids all get hung on that one. For some reason or other, that particular axiom, you know, I shot an arrow into the air, this seems to appeal to kids. Kids and lady poets go for that real big, see? And so I was reading this poetry down in the basement. And it was not a good moment. I must tell you this. It was not a good moment because suddenly my total callousness, or callowness, not callousness, callowness, came rushing back. And I noticed one poem that I didn't really notice it. That came jumping off the page like letters of fire. There was a girl in my class at that time, a girl when I was about 14, named Eileen Akers. Now, Eileen Akers, I have no idea at this point why I dug Eileen Akers. Because I can see her in my mind. She was kind of a scrawny girl with big glasses. And not that there's anything wrong with scrawny girls with big glasses, but she was notably antisocial. Eileen Akers never got herself involved in anything, and I don't think she spoke more than 9 words to me in all the time I knew her. But I went through this thing of digging Eileen Akers. And she was kind of like you know how every class has a wallflower type chick, you know, or a guy who never gets a date or something like that. Well, Eileen Akers was our wallflower for some nutty reason. In the middle of my 14th year, I fell madly in love with Eileen Akers. And therein lies a sordid tale. I wrote a poem to Eileen Akers. And the name of the poem was To Eileen A. Now, you know, you could see I had been touched already by bad literature. You name a poem like that. To Eileen A. Well, that was all right, you know, as long as it stayed in my notebook. Well, one day, I had a locker. You all have lockers, you know, the locker you have in school. And my locker was like my pad. I had pictures inside the door, and I had all kinds of, you know, what stuff I thought was real groovy stuff in there. I had my tennis shoes for gym hanging on the hook in the back, and all this stuff. And right next to me in the next locker was Schwartz. My locker was number 348 on the third floor in the wing of the school. See, way in the back by the door. And there were thousands of lockers in the school. There must have been 3,000 kids go to the school. So, your locker, you kept it your entire school career, 4 years, you stayed in the same locker. Well, you paid a 50-cent a year locker fee. You call them, remember the locker fees and all that stuff? You know, I remember one time getting dunned by the school. I didn't pay my locker fee. And, I just didn't do it. I had the 50 cents, but I didn't, you know, paying a locker fee was kind of a drag. So I didn't pay my locker fee for about 3 or 4 weeks in the beginning of a semester. And I kept getting little white slips that would be given to me every day in homeroom. It says, please pay your locker fee at the office soon, with red lines under it. And one day I came to school and I rushed up to my locker, you know, like mad. I was always about 10 seconds before the final bell for being late. I came running into the school and I rushed up to my locker and I started to open the lock, and they had put another lock on it. That was the first foreclosure I ever had in my life. And, you know, I had to run down to the office and the whole thing, and they came up and they sent up the janitor. He had the special lock, and he opened up the lock, and he said, I won't open the lock till you pay. And so I had to shell out my lunch money, by the way. I shelled out my 50 cents, and then I could get to my gym shoes. But this particular afternoon, me and Schwartz are at our lockers, you know, playing around, had the locker doors open, and I had clipped out from somewhere. I had a picture of this fantastic naked chick, which I had glued to the inside of my locker door. And it was considered very hip to have a naked chick glued inside your locker. A very big thing, see. And Schwartz, because Schwartz had a sardonic sense of humor, he had glued inside of his locker, he had a big picture of a naked gorilla. And, a big, beautiful naked gorilla. Well, you know, this is kid humor, see, so I've got this naked chick there, and Schwartz has got his gorilla there. And so we're standing around, you know, being smart, you know what, standing in front of our locker, and it's 3:30 at night, and school is out. It's right after the last class. And we had this little game we used to play. The game consisted of taking rolled up pieces of paper and pretending like you're dribbling down the hall, and you do these hook shots over your shoulder up, and they had these lights hanging from the ceiling, see, with the kind of like big mushroom-shaped glass white globe things like. Well, you dribble down the hall, see, and you go whoosh, up over your shoulder like that, see, and you throw them up and try to make them go into the globe, and there'd be all kinds of papers up in there, see. Well, Schwartz and I are playing this little game. We're flipping them up like that, and we tired of that, and we're hanging around our locker, and finally it's time to split. And Schwartz says, hey, I smell smoke. I say, yeah, so do I. Oh, my God, no. There's smoke coming out of the chandelier, that big globe thing right over our locker, that the bulbs, they had these big 200-watt bulbs, the bulbs have caught the paper on fire. Have you ever set your own school on fire, kid? I mean, if you haven't, I do not recommend it. It's not one of, theoretically sounds like a groovy thing, but in actuality, oh man, there is a fear that goes through your gut that just don't stop. And so what do? You know? So let's get out of here quick. I said, but George, you can't let it burn like that. There's a couple of sparks are flying out of there, and the smoke is, and a couple of kids see it. They go, I'm going to get out of here. I don't want to get caught down there. See, so I run like mad, you know, down the hall. And Schwartz is running like mad behind me, see. And some lady teacher comes out. I didn't even know who she was. She comes out. She goes, fire, fire. Oh, fire, fire. Oh, we did it. Oh, no. Schwartz and I did it. Well, I ran down to the second floor. And in the meantime, somebody had pulled an alarm. Well, for years, you know, you've been in fire alarm, fire drills in school. And they had this big bell. It would go, doing, 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 doing. Well, people didn't pay any attention to the fire alarm, because you always had fire alarms. They're all still hanging around. Doing, 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 it's going. And then you could hear the sound of sirens coming from miles around. Oh. Well, Schwartz and I went downstairs and hid in the swimming pool. We had this empty swimming pool, which was used only certain months of the year, and it was an empty pool. So Schwartz and I hid in the swimming pool, which was a great place. We used to go to the pool. It was always dark in the swimming pool place. They had this big, like a swimming gym-like, had a track up around the top, and it would be dark. So we hid down there. We could hear yelling and hollering and fire engines. And 20 minutes after, it's all quiet again, and we go up. You can smell smoke. And we crept back up to... Now, by now, the school is almost closed. We went back up to the third floor. And there it was. You could see above the chandelier, there was this big black ring on the ceiling. It had just made the ceiling black. And they had knocked the glass off the chandelier, and the light bulbs were out. And, of course, the fire was out, too. So Schwartz says, don't say nothing. I said, I won't say nothing. Don't forget, man. I'm in this, too. So we quietly opened our lockers. This is a story I have never told because it's a very painful episode. We quietly opened our lockers and took out our stuff that I was taking home. I had this notebook in which was written this poem to Eileen A., I also took my arithmetic book. I believe I also took, if I'm not mistaken, I think I took a civics book. I always did this, you know. It was kind of a routine. I never did anything with them when I got them home. I just took them with me, see. It was like a security blanket. Because it was always in my gut, this deep-seated little flame that always said, you're going to flunk, Shepard. And I felt somehow I was safe if I was carrying a book around. And so we started to walk down the hall. I mean, we were as clean as a whistle, say. I'm walking down the hall, when all of a sudden the door opens to my left. It was one of the scariest, sickening moments of my life. The teacher who had screamed, fire, 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 steps out of that room, and she looked at both of us, and she said, I saw you. You started the fire. Well, it was so totally unexpected that we didn't even deny it. You ever been caught so totally off guard that you couldn't think of anything to say? And she just looked at us for about 30 seconds. She says, I saw you and I'll remember you too. And then she went back into the room and closed the door. She never said anything to anybody about it. Boy, I was scared for a month. You know, I was figuring that, you know, I was going to get the business. And for some reason or other, that day killed my poetry period. The last poem in my notebook was to Eileen A., and it was only two-thirds finished. Because when you become a hardened criminal, it's a whole new set of values you develop. A whole new set of values, completely.